This episode is brought to you in part by the Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
This is Russell Moore, and you're listening to The Russell Moore Show, brought to you by Christianity Today. Every week, we explore conversations and questions from a Christian perspective. And, you know, in this show, it's often fun when I'm talking to somebody that I don't know or I've never talked to before, and I'm learning things from that person. But I like it better when I'm talking to friends so that I can kind of bring you into a conversation that's already going on. And so I'm glad to have that happening today, even though it's precipitated by a sad situation for both of us. My guest today is Peter Wehner, who is senior fellow at the Trinity Forum. He writes for The Atlantic, and you've probably read him in many, many places over the years. And this past a couple of weeks, he wrote a piece, really beautiful piece, in The Atlantic called My Friend Mike Gerson, which was about our friend Mike, who died of cancer at the age of 58. I'd known Mike for a little over 10 years. Pete had known Mike really well, had a close friendship with Mike that went back many years, back to when they both served in the George W. Bush administration. And so the article, this piece, was really beautiful. Now, some of you will know Michael Gerson. You will have read his columns in the Washington Post, or you will have seen him on television or in some other format, but some of you won't. And this show is for you because we're dealing with something that all of us are dealing with: questions of grief, questions of loss, questions of friendship. I find that I'm getting these questions about friendship at an increasing pace, where people are asking, how do I find friends? How do I make friends? What do I do when friendships are split apart by political differences or religious differences or church differences? How can I mend that up, or is it possible? What do I do about loneliness, either in my own life or all around me? So we're going to talk about all of those things today. And so, Pete Wehner, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Russell. I'm a huge admirer of yours, of your faith and of your character and your courage. So I'm delighted to be with you and part of CT.
Well, likewise. And the piece that you did, my friend Mike Gerson, it hit me really hard. And I think for a couple of reasons. I mean, we have a book club together, which is really, in many ways, kind of a lifeline for me. It's just it's a unique experience of fellowship that my wife knows. And to read you writing about somebody who was always there and won't be anymore hit hard. But then I thought to myself, what if I didn't know either of them? And I thought this piece would still hit that hard because it's dealing with something really universal when it comes to friendship and to grief. You talk about in that piece that you joked to Mike in one of the times leading up to his death, of all of the biblical characters that you could emulate, why did you choose Job? Because of he had been through these health problems for so long. And it is kind of remarkable to see in Mike, and I've seen it in some other people, who suffer so well. What do you think it is in people that causes them to be a model when it comes to suffering?
Yeah, it's a great question. And Mike really did suffer well. I should say that in the last few weeks of his life, and he went through an unbelievable set, a litany of issues, including first he had kidney cancer, and then it spread and metastasized to lung cancer, adrenal cancer, and bone cancer, which is what he died from. He also had Parkinson's disease, but it was very painful. In the last several weeks of his life when he was in the hospital, I helped coordinate with some others, people to see Mike one or two at a time, once or twice a day, depending on how well that he felt. And it was a chance for people to express to him what he meant to them, and him, even in a very weakened state, to express what they meant to him. And what was striking to me and to others was the through line of those last few weeks, and really through all of Mike's life, and even through the suffering that began years ago, was gratitude. What moved him most, what moved him to tears in those last few weeks, is he spoke about gratitude, even in the midst of this terrible pain and suffering that he went through. So he really did suffer well. What is it that allows people to suffer well? It's a deep question. I mean, I think some of it probably just goes to disposition and temperament and attitude toward life. Mike himself sort of referred to himself as almost a reflexive Calvinist. So he never really dealt with the questions of why God, why me. He didn't feel that those questions were off limits by any means. It's just not ones that he struggled with. There was a sense of dignity in Mike. I know that he wanted to conduct himself in a way that reflected well, above all, to his two boys, Nick and Bucky. So that was part of it. And then faith was a very deep part of it. Faith was so inextricable to who Mike was, and it touched, I think, almost every area of his life. Not perfectly. He was an imperfect person. He would be the first person to tell you that. But I think every area of his life was, to one degree or another, touched by faith, including that, maybe even preeminently, the road to death, and the fact that he felt like, you know, we were citizens of another kingdom, of another world, gave him hope, the kind of hope that we as people of the Christian faith rely on. But you know, you never really know how deep it goes or how it manifests itself until the critical moments of life, until there's pain or there's loss or there's suffering.
Yeah.
And, you know, we like to think that we're going to hold up well, but we're never sure. But he did, and he did model, not only for his boys, but for the rest of us, how to suffer well and how to withstand and pain with dignity and grace.
You know, I think every time that I see God's grace at work in that way, I just realize what an ungrateful person I am, because I experience gratitude, but it seems to me that those moments of really intense gratitude sort of come in flashes, and I don't live out a life where I'm stopping to pay attention to, look at what God has given you. Are you grateful for this? And it seems to me that somebody to have that kind of disposition at the end of life, gratitude has to be cultivated. I wonder, how do you cultivate gratitude in the daily, in the ordinary, rather than in just the crises?
I will say that I think it's probably true of almost all of us, right? Which is, the best moments in life come in flashes. That's just the nature of the human condition, and I suppose the human struggle. Moments of deep insight or contemplation or gratitude, those kind of things, they don't sustain us, but they do come in flashes. And when they come in flashes, they often stay with us, or they mark us in a way that leaves an imprint. Gratitude is, I wrote an essay actually several years ago in the New York Times, one of my faith essays in the Times, on the virtue of gratitude. I think it's an underappreciated virtue, because I think a lot of other virtues spring from a sense of gratitude. In terms of how do you cultivate it, part of it, I think, is the company that you keep. Are there people around you who themselves are able to manifest gratitude and remind you of what you have to be grateful for. My wife will sometimes say to me and to our children during moments, even if they're moments, actually often if they're moments of struggle or hardship, what are some of the things you're grateful for? That is just giving voice to it, just shifting your perspective and your mindset, and having people in your life who can put the right frame on life, which is that there are moments of hardship, but reasons for gratitude, including in the context of faith. I would say also that, at least in my experience, some of it is context. It's what's the expectation of life. I think if people go into life assuming that life is going to be a walk in a park and that they're owed certain things by God, by others, and then you skin your knees and your arms once you encounter life, then you can go through it, and it's a sense that you're always being denied something you're owed.
Yeah.
And so having the expectation of receiving with open hands and open arms the gifts that you're given, but to know that often life is a vale of tears, and it's a struggle, I've found that that can be helpful as well.
Well, those high expectations really do crush us, whether it's in our own lives or accomplishments or relationships or suffering. If you have that sense of I'm owed exactly what my vision of the future is,
right. Yeah,
you're right. That does lead to a great deal of despair. Pete, you've worked in Washington for a long time. I mentioned at the beginning that you and Mike both were serving in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, and you served as, you led Empower America think tank. You served at Ethics and Public Policy Center. We worked with Jack Kemp and with other people over the years. I'm struck by, often people will say, especially in a context like Washington, which is about power a great deal of the time, it's better to be feared than loved. Sort of the LBJ kind of mentality. But I was also struck this week by the fact that with Mike's death, he was loved more than he was feared. And that is what was remarkable. And it seems to me that that's what I see in the people who really have lived worthy lives in that sort of a context, even to the point that Yuval Levin, another friend of ours, in his essay said that it was interesting to him that when Mike was at the height of his power in the White House, that's when he was the most passionate for injustice against those who were weak, AIDS victims in Africa and other places. How would you advise someone? Because we have listeners who are starting their careers. Maybe they're working in government. Maybe they're working in business or working in various places. How should they think about ambition and power at the beginning of life so that they don't end up sort of being swept away by it?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I agree with what you said for sure. I mean, Mike wasn't feared by anyone I know, but he was very much loved by many people, and he lived a deeply consequential life, in part because he was loved, because he had who he was gave him a certain place in the hearts and minds of a lot of people, including influential people who came to love him like a brother, as President Bush said to me. I loved him like a brother. And that was authentic, that relationship. But out of that relationship came great good, including what you mentioned, Pat Farr. In terms of what I would recommend to people when they're young and they're approaching it, and how do you view power and how do you inoculate yourself to the degree one can against the dangers of it. I see several things. The first is just to remember that what's important is to be faithful in your life, not necessarily to be successful. I mean, that's a sort of obvious point, but it's really important because, for one thing, it keeps
me obvious to say, not obvious to live.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important in part because people can become fatalistic when things aren't going well, or they feel like important endeavors that they're a part of aren't turning out the way they wanted. And we don't really have control often over the success of an enterprise, but we do have control over how faithful we are and the shape of our character. And so that's one thing. The other is to understand and be surrounded by people who understand what is power for. It's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And the means to the end, certainly as people of the Christian faith, is to advance justice and God's kingdom and the moral good, to be an instrument of healing and repair and reconciliation and truth. It's not an end which is, you know, your own pride and your own ambition. Again, that's obvious to say. It's harder to live. All of us deal with pride, and there's good ambition and there's bad ambition, and all of us, most of us deal with both, and all of us have some degree of ambition which is tainted by pride. It's very important, I think, to have those people around us who can speak into your life, who have the standing in your life to be able to tell you if you're beginning to go off course, and can speak honestly to you. I think part of it is to have role models. I think it's a really big deal. I mean, and this is autobiographical, I suppose, but to have the right role models in your life. You know, one of the things I do, you may do this too, Russell, from time to time. It's a very simple thing, but when I think about sometimes what I write, right, and I write directly and I write forcefully, and sometimes there's real energy behind what I write, and there's always a question with me, which is, have I gone too far? Have I been unfair? Have I said things that I shouldn't have said? And I'm sure I have, but I haven't done it as often as I would have done it because I think about certain people in my life whom I respect and admired, who had shaped me, and I just say, what would they say? If I wrote this, if I said this, if I did this, if my life was open, an open book, it was not in shadows, and those people knew what was happening, what would their reaction be? Doesn't mean that I'm always going to follow it, but it does mean that there's some kind of check on the use of power and other things and how one conducts them themselves. The other thing is, I just think that there is something of a myth. Maybe it's not a myth, but it's an incomplete view of how one has influence. And it's not using power in a ruthless way to try and gain standing and to have influence. There are plenty of people in public life, in politics, in other arenas of life who have kept and maintained their integrity and character and been successful and been influential. And I think if you get into a mindset that pits your own ambitions to power against moral integrity and being honest and treating people decently, that's a conflict. And sometimes they exist, and you should choose integrity, but people don't always do it. Yeah. But I'm not cynical. For all my years in politics, and I think I understand the downside of politics, and I've certainly been exposed to people who I think their integrity has been questionable. But I've met a lot of really good people of real character in politics, and you can be a person of integrity and succeed in politics, and politics matters. People, they can't become cynical, in my estimation, of politics, because politics is finally and fundamentally about justice, about a lot of other things too, but it's about justice. And people of the Christian faith and others too can't shrug or be indifferent to it. So, you don't have to be ruthless to get power or to exercise power. And when you do get power, you should do it responsibly.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/RussellMoore.
While you were talking, I had a song running through my head, Paul Simon singing, "Who'll Be My Role Model Now That My Role Models Are Gone?" Because there are a lot of people who have role models in their lives, people that they've looked up to, people that they wanted to be like, and then they're really disappointed by those people later on. And I think what's happened is for some people, there's a sense of fear. I can't even really learn from anybody, because what happens if this person ends up just being just another fraud at the worst end, or even if not fraud, just a hack, you know? And I think that can happen in any context, in a business context, a church context, a political context. How do we do that? How do we learn from role models, even when sometimes it's just really disappointing?
Yeah, I think when there are situations in which the people that we've elevated to role models, heroes in our lives, and they fall short, that can be a very difficult experience and wounding experience. And it can create some amount of cynicism in the sense of, everybody has clay feet, no one can be trusted, and that's a danger. But it does happen. When that happens, I think what we need is the discernment, the wisdom to be able to say, what are the qualities of that individual that are still worth emulating, even if there are other areas of their lives that are not? People are complicated. You take people in the totality of their acts. And some people embody virtues like courage, and they may then have other vices in their life, and they exist. They can exist together. And it's the ability to see in an honest way, what are the virtues, what are the vices, not throw the baby out with the bathwater, and to say, from this person, I learned this, but I also learned that as well. And then there are people, if you're fortunate in your life, who, again, are not perfect, but in the sum total of their life, you say, that's a person worth emulating.
Yeah.
Those are the people who are trustworthy, who are honorable, who are trying, even if imperfectly, to do the right thing. And when you find those people, it matters, and it matters to stay in touch with them, to learn from them, and to give back to them.
You know, Maria, my wife, often will groan when I say this or laugh, because I've often said, I love a good funeral more than I love a wedding. And she will say, that is so morbid. But the reason is because of exactly what you just said. When I'm at a funeral for somebody who, again, not perfect, of course, but somebody who has faithfully lived out the arc of a life, there's just so much grace seen in that, and so much hope seen in it. And I always walk away sort of reminded of what matters and what doesn't. And it sort of recalibrates expectations. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. You look at that whole arc of a life, and when you see fidelity, and you often can, it's really an invigorating and remarkable thing.
Yeah, well, our friend David Brooks has talked about the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. And in the end, the eulogy virtues are the ones that matter most. And they're the ones that when we look back over, as you said, the arc of our life, those are the ones that for most of us will matter. How are we as friends, as spouses, as sons and daughters, as citizens, what was the moral arc of our lives?
You know, I think if we were to go back in a time machine 10 years ago to 2012, 2013, and we were to say to Russell Moore and Pete Wehner then, your eulogy one day will probably include the words Donald Trump. Not probably, will almost definitely include the words Donald Trump. I think both of us would have said, Donald Trump, the billionaire? What are you talking, the apprentice guy? And it would have been kind of shocking to us that that would be the case. And of course, then the next decade played out, which, you know, we're very clear and on the record as to where we are. Not all of our listeners have to be, and we'll have different opinions, of course, but we have come to certain conclusions. And as a result of that, there are a lot of people, I know this is true of you, I know for sure it's true of me, a lot of people who won't even speak to me anymore. Who would have been very close in 2012, 2013. And I found just thinking about that, that it applies outside of the context of that traumatic sort of division that has happened over Trump and related things over the past several years. There are a lot of people who, even when they don't weigh into those sorts of things, they find friendships that break apart and they find them fragmenting. And you wrote about this maybe a year or two ago about the evangelical breakup, talking about what's happening in the church. Do you think that that's especially happening now? Is it just something that has always happened, friendships build and friendships divide? Or is there something about this moment that makes that different?
I think there's something about this moment that makes it different. May not be qualitatively different because politics and theology, precisely because they're about important matters, and people have passions about those things, and often should have passions about them. You know, relationships can be complicated by differences over those things. If you have strongly held opinions and the person holds contrary opinions, then that, you know, that has the makings of strains for sure. But there's no question in my mind, from my experience and the experience of most people that I know, that this is a different moment, that churches have been split in a way that hasn't been the case before. You would know better than I, but I know an awful lot of pastors and they testify to that. And how difficult it is for pastors who are themselves not political, but dealing with congregations mm-hmm. that have been energized and animated through politics, through cultural issues, families that are divided, parents and children who don't speak to each other anymore, people who are formerly colleagues who either don't speak to each other or are angry at one another. So it's different. This is way trickier to navigate than any other time in my experience in politics, and that's true of most people I know. And I don't think there's anybody that I know that would say that it's easier today than it has been in the past.
Do you think social media is the reason for that, for the difference that we have now?
I think social media is a big part of it. I don't think it's the only part of it. Social media, I think, plays a part because it in a sense creates a kind of civic culture and the terms of debate. I think it pulls it down in part because when people are on social media, there's not the filter. There's a lot of anonymity that happens. People throw out statements that they wouldn't throw out if you were person to person, or if you waited 5 or 10 minutes that you wouldn't do. Both sides get into it, and there's a lot of heat, and often not much not much light. So I think that it happens both for people who are on social media and just the radiating effects, I would say, of social media in terms of how we speak with one another. But I think even if social media didn't exist, I think our politics is at a point where the anger, the grievances, the frustrations are deeper than in the past. And the style of politics that's being employed, I would say, especially over the last half dozen years or so, in my estimation, and I realize there are people who disagree with me, but I think it was embodied largely in Donald Trump. I think he validated certain approaches to politics that often people felt, but leaders in politics kept it on the fringes. And I think now we're in a time in which there's a kind of dehumanization that occurs that's not only accepted but often celebrated. And so I think that's happened. I think just a lot of guardrails have been smashed and thrown away. And as I said, there's just a lot of anger. And I think that would exist without social media, but I think it's certainly been amplified by it.
You know, the story that was being told for a while was that the reason that we have all this animosity in the United States is that there are no longer swing voters, that everybody's just mobilizing their bases, and that's what elections are. But if we look at the midterm elections that just ended, remember leading up to it, Carrie Lake, who was the Republican candidate for governor of Arizona, stood up at a rally and said, "Are there any John McCain Republicans out there? Get out of here if you are," which would have just been nonsensical in any other time. You would have thought you want every vote you can get. But in the end, that's what ended up making the difference were swing voters and people who were splitting their ticket or voting differently than they had in the past. Do you see in that some hope? Maybe we're not just turning into red America versus blue America in all these monolithic ways. Is there some hope there?
I think so. I mean, I'd say just as a broad statement, I think the American capacity for self-renewal is really impressive. It's one of the impressive things in the history of the world. And also viruses create their own antibodies. So the division, the acrimony, the anger, the hatred that marks politics, I think for a majority of people, they're not really happy with that. That's a good thing. There was a study a few years ago leading up to the 2020 election called the exhausted majority. And I think that captured what was happening. The weird thing that's going on is our politics is so amped up because I think there are certain structural problems. One of the things which you know about is that often members of Congress, particularly in the House, their main fear is not a general election, it's a primary election, which is determined by the base of a party, which tends to be the most energized and extreme part of a party. And so you've got a lot of people who are playing to that. So that's one thing. Second thing is that the number of true independents, people who split their votes, is relatively small. So a lot of politicians have made the calculation that we have to go for turnout, not for appealing to independents. I think this last midterm election pushes back somewhat against it for the reason you said. You had massive turnout. You've had actually massive turnout for the last three elections. 2018 midterm was a record turnout for a midterm. The 2020 presidential election was a record turnout. And then this last one, 2022, was a near record turnout. So you've got both bases turning out in huge numbers, which means that there needs to be an appeal to some independence and a hope for people who split their votes. We'll have to see. I mean, in politics, winning is replicated, and I think what has to happen is that there have to be figures in both parties and individuals in both movements that model a different kind of politics and shows it can win. And I think once that happens, you'll get a lot of people who will follow. Or the reverse, which is if you model a certain kind of politics, dehumanization, hatred, conspiracy theories, and so forth, that you'll lose. That's the language, unfortunately, that a lot of people in politics understand. Moral appeals don't always work. But if they think that decency is a pathway to victory, then you've got a chance to see it on a more widespread basis. And that in turn just depends on what we, the American people, do. We're not, corks caught in currents that we have mm-hmm. no control over. I mean, this is a self-governing republic. Yeah. It feels that way. But in the end, we get more or less the government that we deserve. And we need enough people who care about the right things to make their voices heard. Voting is one way. There are a lot of others. But if that happens, if people stand up for honor and decency and integrity, then our politics will resemble that. If people don't, if they are themselves peddling, interested in, advocating, looking for others to push for dehumanization and hate, we'll get that. But this is an ongoing struggle, mm-hmm. and it's never settled. It's never settled.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m. we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on. And on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come, all in one place.
Mike Cosper and I were talking on The Bulletin last week, or maybe the week before, about something that Adam Kinzinger said that is completely true in my experience, not only in the political realm, but also in the church realm. He said there are a lot of people who think that the reason that you have members of Congress who think one thing and say another, which is, as you know, a lot of them, the reason for that is not so much that they're thinking, here's power and I want to accumulate this power, although there is some of that. He said that a lot of it is just not wanting to deal with the grief of going back to your Lincoln day, if you're a Republican, or your Jefferson Jackson day. I guess they probably don't have Jefferson Jackson Day dinners anymore, but whatever they're being called now, you don't want to get the grief from people coming up. And I thought about a United States senator who was talking about why he didn't take a convictional stand on a particular issue, even though he was retiring. And he said, I want to go to Hardee's and drink coffee on Saturday mornings, and I won't be able to do that if I vote the other way. I just don't want the grief. And I've seen that a lot in churches in which you have pastors or other leaders who are saying, I just have to get through the next few weeks. How does one make the decision? What's worth just saying, I'm going to hold on and address that later? And what's worth saying, okay, I have to address this right now, even if nobody will speak to me after it? How does a person make that decision in the moment?
Yeah, it can be tricky. And I think the human impulse is always to defer mm-hmm. because people don't want to have their lives unsettled. They don't like the winds and the rains. They'd rather go through and not be hassled. They'd rather be able to go to Hardee's. I think it really depends on some understanding, some discernment in terms of what the moment is about. Mm-hmm. Is this a fundamentally important moment, or is this an ephemeral moment? Is this an issue that really matters, that goes to the core of certain things, or are these the kind of differences that people can have? And, you know, they flare up. You have a debate 1 week, and 3 weeks later, it's forgotten. If you're talking about what the top tax rate should be, is it 41% or 37% or 28%? That's a legitimate issue to debate. People can have opinions about it. It's not necessarily worth going to the mat over, at least in my estimation. If you're talking about fundamental issues of truth, of American democracy, of either the survival of a country that can be melodramatic, or the pillars of society that are necessary for a country to allow for human flourishing. On those matters of faith, matters of deep principle, I think then you should speak up, and then it's a matter of whether people do. But it requires courage, and John Kennedy said about there's a reason that profiles in courage is a slim volume. Mm-hmm. It's not a virtue that a lot of people have. It's an important one. Aristotle said it was the first of all the virtues, and a lot of others are derivative from it. But most people want to go along to get along, and mm-hmm. they rather avoid these things. And then I think when people do it, The human mind, human psychology kicks in, and we have a tremendous ability, and I'm speaking here about myself too, just to rationalize certain mm-hmm. kinds of behavior. Because people, none of us lives easily with cognitive dissonance. If you are living at odds with what you purport to believe or what you really do believe, and your actions don't correspond to that, that can create a tremendous amount of internal tension. And so the mind then begins to set up a series of justifications and rationalizations for not doing the right thing, or even for doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's happened a lot. People have come up with an awful lot of excuses of why they shouldn't speak up, when on some deep level they knew it was important to speak up and that they should speak up.
Yeah, one of the things that's really shocking to me right now is seeing, for instance, the Paul Pelosi attack with a hammer. It's not that sort of thing happens. We've had political assassinations and attempted assassinations at many points in American history. What was shocking to me is that this happened, and there were so many people who would joke about it.
Yes.
And prominent people who would joke about it. And there was this lack of humanity. And I noticed the same thing on the right and on the left. I was noticing there's a right-wing figure who's suffering from COVID right now. And I just looked at the responses on social media, and you had people, this is what you deserve, sort of
right.
a thing. And you see it in probably right now more on the right. Do you see that than on the left? But it exists in both places. And we started out talking about Mike Gerson. One of the things that I was noticing when it was announced that he died is that there were some people who would say, well, he wrote speeches that were for George W. Bush in the lead up to the Iraq War. That means that this is an evil person. Doesn't matter what he did with AIDS in Africa and so forth. And it's not only that's just really callous at a time of someone's death. It's also, I think, because people don't realize and remember what it seemed was going on at the beginning of the Iraq War, or what it really did seem as though Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, that would be the case. And so there were a lot of us who supported military action in Iraq. back after September 11th, who looking back would say, well, if we knew everything that we know now, we wouldn't have done that. I'm not assuming that you have a different opinion of the Iraq War than you did when you were in the Bush administration. I'm just asking you, there are going to be things, not just in those big policy levels, but there are going to be things that a pastor does or that a mom does or that somebody in their business, something that looking back, they say, I regret that. I wish that I had done that differently. And I've seen people handle that different ways. I've seen some people sort of double down and just become really cynical. And I've seen people kind of fall into despair and lose their confidence when they have some regrets. How do you counsel people to deal with regret and mistakes that they've made in life?
Yeah, I'll just say, because on the Iraq War, I mean, I do have regrets, two really large, I would say significant ones on that. The first was that we went to war based on a false premise, which is that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. That was not something that we knew about. So it wasn't a failure of character in that sense. Nobody was lying about it. The simple way to know that is nobody would go forward and articulate the premises of a war that you knew would be shown to be false once the war mm-hmm. began. Mm-hmm. And somebody like Colin Powell, who was not a warmonger, went before the UN. He'd spent three nights, 2 days at Langley at CIA to go over the information when he did the UN speech. So in that case, it was not a willing, it wasn't a lie. It wasn't willingly misled. Having said that, it was wrong. And we said things that were wrong, and it had tremendous consequences. We tried to do due diligence, but we didn't do it well enough, and that is really on us. And the second thing is that the Phase 4 operation after the major combat operations, we had the wrong premise in terms of what was needed in Iraq. It was the light footprint strategy, which allowed chaos to go forward. So that is a regret that I have. And I think it's important to be able to acknowledge that if the facts, lead you to that. In terms of how people in general deal with regret in their life, whether it's personal or professional, some of it depends, I think, on of course, on the magnitude of the regret, so that facts and circumstances matter. If there are individuals that you have hurt or wounded or slandered, it's important to repair those and repair mm-hmm. those, I think, in an honest way, to go to people and to speak honestly about that and do what you can to repair that. And if it's non-personal, but it has to do with professional issues or other matters, you just try and correct what went wrong. But all of us have regrets in life. Mm-hmm. All of us have stumbled and fallen. Paul referred to himself as the chief of sinners. So we have to be able to accept grace for regrets. I found in life, you may have too, that in order to be a dispenser of grace, you have to have been the recipient. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily you have to have been, but it helps to have been the recipient of grace yourself. Yeah. Knowing grace from God, having received grace from others. And when you've received that grace, I think it's easier for you to give it. And I think it's important that people, not beat themselves up for not having led a perfect life. So you try and correct what it is that you regret, but then you go on in life. You don't try not to let it shadow you. You learn from it if you're wise yourself, and you have other people to try and help you learn from it. And in the end, you hope that your life has more pluses than minuses when the story's told.
When I think about this issue, I think a lot about Amanda Ripley, who talks about, and I don't like the war metaphor with anything, but she talks about the necessity to be able to welcome back enemy combatants.
Right.
Really, no matter what, no matter how big or small the issue is, where people actually can change their minds, and that's not going to be held over them. So that you may have someone maybe in a church or in a small group that was really wrong and maybe behaved really badly in some situation, you have to be willing for those people to change their minds and to be greeted back in the community. Because otherwise, what you end up with is this sense of, okay, I've already made this step, and that means I can only keep walking in this direction.
Right.
That's not only a violation of a Christian understanding of grace, it also doesn't work.
Right.
And I think we're living in a time where that is maybe the hardest thing in American life, is for people, A, to change their minds on something,
right,
but B, to be welcomed back once they have.
Yeah, that's good insight. It's true. Sometimes there's a feeling of wanting to hold it over a person, mm-hmm. and saying, even if you change your mind, you're not welcome back because you got it wrong, for a long period of time, or because of what you said or did when you did have it wrong. But I think from a Christian perspective, it's not the right way to approach it. And you're also right that from a utilitarian perspective, it doesn't work either. I mean, you have to give people in life exit ramps and entrance ramps, to be able to get off of certain roads that they're on and to enter into or join certain roads that they're on. And we shouldn't go out of our way to make that, you know, more or less difficult. It's one other thing that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to touch on, because I think it's an important point, which is this idea about, you know, when we are dealing with people who have views that are different than ours. You were mentioning some people, like with the Iraq War with Mike and others. It's the sense that if a person holds views that are different than mine, it must be evidence of a deep character flaw,
right?
Or that they themselves are wicked, and that's a challenge that we all have. And it's a challenge in politics. It's a challenge in theology. It's a challenge in all sorts of different arenas of life. And I think the mistake that we make is we assume that other people have the same hierarchy of values and often the same life experiences, the same shaping influences. And so if somebody arrives at a position that's different than ours, I think we often think, how could they arrive at a different position? Because they think that the experiences of the other people are the same as us, their thought mm-hmm. process is the same, the value systems that they hold are the same. And if that were the case, then the only way that they could end up on the wrong side, quote unquote, of an issue is if it was a character defect.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, all of us are shaped by so many different factors, family mm-hmm. of origin, the community we're part of, teachers that we had, the country that we're a part of, the sources of information that we rely on. Jonathan Haidt, our mutual friend, the social psychologist at NYU, wrote The Righteous Mind, talks about how liberals and conservatives put premium on different values. We're all bringing to life different grids, and mm-hmm. that's how we often end up at different points or different positions. And if you lose sight of that, I think that is often why we end up feeling like we want to shake somebody and say, how can you believe this?
Mm-hmm.
Or why don't you see things the same way that I do? So some degree of, I'd say, epistemic humility is in order for all of us, including me.
We mentioned a few minutes ago our eulogies, and I'm curious, what would you hope for your own life? When we do, let's hope many, 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 many years from now, when the people are there honoring your life. What would you hope that people would say about Pete Wehner?
It's a kind of moving question. I guess what I would hope that they would say is that my life in the main was a life of integrity, that I loved well, that I loved particularly family and friends, but others well. And that I was, I tried to be faithful servant of Christ. I got things wrong for sure, but that's what I was trying to do and to be.
Well, I think there are many of us who can give that testimony about you now, and we don't want to give that testimony about you in a eulogy sense for a long, long time, but we could definitely see that in your life right now. Pete, I'm just really grateful for your, not just your insight and your wisdom, but your friendship. There are so many times when I've told Maria, I don't know that I would be sane if it weren't for a very small group of people, including Pete Wehner, through this time. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm really grateful for your taking time to be with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Russell. As I said, I'm a great admirer of you. And we've always needed your voice, but more now than ever. And I count you as a close friend. And one of the people, when I was talking about models, you're one of them. So thanks for your ministry, thanks for your friendship, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
And we'll keep a slot open for Mike in the book club, and we will see him soon.
Yeah. Amen.
Thank you for listening to The Russell Moore Show today. Be sure to subscribe, send it along to somebody that you think would benefit from this conversation. Leave a review, helps folks to find us. And click on the cover art if you're listening on a smartphone, and you can find additional resources, including how to find links to some of the articles by Pete Wehner that we talked about in this broadcast. This is Russell Moore. You're listening to The Russell Moore Show, brought to you by Christianity Today.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosbert. Hosted by Russell Moore, produced by Ashley Hales. Associate producers Abby Perry and Azrae Phelps. CT administration provided by Christine Kolb. Social media by Kate Lucky. Director of operations for CT Media is Matt Stevens. Production assistance provided by Core Media. Audio engineer is Kevin Duthu. Coordinator is Beth Grabencourt. Video producer is John Rowland. The theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.